On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we prepare for the California ASC Association meeting in Monterey. We'll discuss the 2018 report to Congress on the deemed status accreditation organizations and discuss three of the major risk assessments that ASCs must do each year.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 64 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for September 3rd, 2019. We're recording from our brand new studio in Spencerport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey. He is the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So we're here in our new studio, as I said.
This is great. It's absolutely quiet. Yes. Unlike upstairs in the office where mm-hmm. we have all kinds of background noises, including the dog walking around.
Yep, so it's kind of our dedicated space down here.
It is. It's almost too quiet.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
It is. I was just thinking because we don't hear anything at all in here. Yeah. But the sound is absolutely incredible. So hopefully this is what our audience hears too. That sounds as good as it does in our headphones, and mm-hmm. we're in good shape. Mm-hmm. The only problem is we're further apart in here, so it's harder to see you. I have to
figure something out. We're both facing the same way, so we're kind of
angling
our heads to try to look at each other. Feel like you're talking to the wall.
We're going to have to get a picture so people can see how we have to do this. So we have this brand new studios in our home. It gives us, unlike our old studio, which is still up there, which can only record with two people, this place can accommodate six, probably even eight people mm-hmm. in here. We have a brand new, well, it's not new, it's a used board, but a board with twice the capability of the other ones, and new microphones here too. And also we should point out that we have a full portable studio now.
Yep.
So in addition to this studio, the one upstairs, we have one that goes on the road with us, which allows us to record between four and six microphones at a time.
Mm-hmm. We're going to California with it.
And we're going to California with it. So I double-checked it and triple-checked it, so hopefully we won't have that problem we had last time we went out there.
Yeah.
I should also point out, Sue, that we have video recording capability also.
Yeah.
So that little camera in the corner there, it's not on, trust me.
I know. I'd be paying attention to that.
And we have a green screen also, but so that's something in the future. That mm-hmm. But that camera, it looks pretty intimidating over there, but it's not hooked up to anything yet other than a power source. So
yeah.
I do want to remind everybody that we love going on the road, and we love working with the various state associations, supporting them in whichever way mm-hmm. we can. We do special podcasts. Right now we've been doing it for, New York, New Jersey, mm-hmm. California, Pennsylvania, Ohio. And I know there are others that have expressed some interest in it. So please feel free to invite us. We don't charge people, of course, to mm-hmm. Do a podcast and any other special conferences. So there are sometimes conferences that are not associated with the state association that might be interested in.
And we'll often do a special episode that is more geared toward the particular state. And you can kind of say anything that's happening locally. And then we'll do a broader podcast. Those tend to be pretty popular.
They are. Actually, the most popular podcast ever is our New York State Association mm-hmm. conference, the one that we just did with well over 300 downloads. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, to that end, we are heading out to California tomorrow morning. So we're recording about 7 o'clock. And I got to wake you up at 3 o'clock in order to get to the airport.
Start by four. Yep. Finish packing tonight and we'll be on our way. That's not my favorite part of it. I do like doing the podcast, but those early mornings.
But we love the California Association. They are very supportive of us, and we are very supportive of them, of course. And we're going to be recording a few speakers for future episodes. So, and we'll, as you mentioned, we're going to be recording a special episode for California. And I'm also going to be moderating a session on quality improvement. I'm very excited about this. It's a panel discussion. We got three very diverse individuals, one representing the insurance industry and the buyers of healthcare services. And we have somebody from an organization that does surveys. And lastly, another industry expert who can talk a little bit about the provider side. So we're basically looking to see how do we get our message across about quality and how do outside organizations view us as an industry and how do we change that attitude or how do we get that message across? Because we certainly have a great message that we want everybody to hear.
Yeah, I think we learn a lot at these conferences, too. I do enjoy them.
Absolutely. And so we're going to be recording a regular episode there and a special episode for California. And we're also going to be recording an episode for our newest sponsor, which is CareDirect, a company that manufactures medication security cabinets. And I'm thinking that that episode will come out either the end of September or beginning of October. Not quite sure when that'll hit. And by the way, Sue, as I mentioned, I think I made quite a deal about it to you a couple days ago. We breezed past the 10,000 download level. It's been an incredible 2-week period since our last episode with almost 500 downloads. So I don't know what's going on, but we're definitely getting a lot of new listeners. We're over 1,000 downloads per month now. And so I want to welcome all of our new listeners out there and thank you very much for supporting us. And I should point out, let's put a little plug in here. We're always looking for sponsors of the podcast. If you're interested, certainly please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. Those of you that listen to us know that we do very little sponsorship here, really. It's just Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and the publisher of the books, Eden Group Development, that do the vast majority of our podcasts. But you'll find that our prices are very reasonable, actually exceedingly reasonable compared to other options that you might have out there. It's a great way of getting your product exposed to some of the best ASCs in the country. Of course, those who listen to us.
And
that's right. And note that we do review all of our sponsors prior to accepting them. So we don't just accept anybody, of course, because anybody we put on the show has to have a good product to sell and something that we're comfortable with.
Yeah, we definitely have to believe in you and feel good about the message we're sending.
That's right. I do want to make an apology here. I am behind in updating the website. I think I've got all of the podcasts listed up there. There just isn't enough hours in the day, and unfortunately, that's one of the things that gets missed. The podcasts are always published, so they always go to iTunes and Google, but I don't always get the website itself. But as of about a half an hour ago, this is a Tuesday, the 3rd that we're recording, as of about an hour ago, I did get them all listed up there, but I still have to get some of the resources posted to the various episodes, so I apologize about that. And hopefully next week I'll get everything all caught up. So let's move on to the news of the industry.
So the fiscal year 2018 report to Congress, the review of Medicare's program oversight of accrediting organizations, and the clinical laboratory improvement amendments of 1988 our CLIA validation program just recently came out.
Right. So that didn't exactly sound the most exciting title there.
I am sorry.
No, there's no way to make that exciting. But it is actually a very interesting report. I pored over it for a couple hours yesterday, and I just wanted to kind of mention some of these things. So basically, on an annual basis, the Social Security Act requires that that CMS submit an annual report to Congress on its oversight of the national accrediting organizations and their CMS-approved accreditation programs. So as we know, you could choose to get your Medicare certification surveys done by an accrediting organization such as HHC, the Joint Commission, or HFAP or QuadASF. And CMS requires a performance evaluation of each of those CMS-approved accreditation organizations to verify that the entity demonstrates compliance with Medicare conditions for participation for the hospitals and conditions for coverage for the ambulatory surgery centers, including the oversight of the ambulatory surgery center deemed status program. So this is a very important process to make sure that the accrediting organizations are doing good surveys. And this report is published every year. This is the first time we've really talked about it. One thing that came out of the report, which I think was extremely interesting, is CMS is piloting a more streamlined way to assess the accrediting organization's ability to ensure that the facilities and surveyors comply with all the CMS requirements. So the surveyors are being surveyed. So historically, CMS has measured the effectiveness of the accrediting organizations by choosing a random sample of the facilities, and they perform a state-conducted assessment survey within 60 days from the accreditation survey. So unfortunately, that means for probably about 5 to 10% of surveyed organizations, they just have a deemed status survey, and then within 60 days, they get another survey by the state. So under this pilot project, CMS is eliminating the second state-conducted validation survey, and instead, they're going to use direct observation during the original survey that's done by the accrediting organization. Yeah. So that means that state surveyors will be attending the surveys with the accrediting organization surveyors. Mm. So while
seems a little nerve-wracking for the center, it's a lot of
There's a lot of people there, in. and then speaking as a surveyor, that's nerve-wracking for us. So you know, not only do we have the organization that's probably not terribly happy that we're there, but we got CMS watching over our shoulders. So speaking as a surveyor, I'm not terribly happy with this, but for the organization, that does mean that they would only be subjected to one survey as opposed to two surveys. So CMS believes that direct observation will allow them to not only evaluate the accrediting organization's performance more effectively, but also to make suggestions for improvements and address concerns with the accrediting organization's surveyors immediately, which is even more nerve-wracking for surveyors like myself. So,
and it seems like when people know they're being watched, they may act differently. So I'm not sure that this is going to be a more valid way of checking than coming in after when they
It's
Nobody
totally
knew
independent.
You were coming.
I kind of agree with you. But this approach is another example of the wide-ranging effort of CMS to eliminate duplication and relieve burden on the organizations, reducing the amount of time that healthcare organizations must spend on compliance activities. So you got to appreciate the fact that they really are working to find ways to streamline things. So just a little bit of background. CMS currently has 5 approved Medicare accreditation programs for ambulatory surgery centers. That's the American Association of Accreditation for Ambulatory Surgical Facilities, better known as QuAD-ASF. The Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, which is the AAHC, Health Facilities Accreditation Program, better known as HFAP, the Institute for Medical Quality, or IMQ, and the Joint Commission, which is TJC, or the old term, which is JCO, which we're not supposed to use anymore. So here's just a few statistics. There are 5,580 ASCs that were monitored in 2017. 29%, or 1,631, used deemed status surveys. So that only that means only less than a third actually subject themselves to a deemed status survey. And 71%, or 3,949, use other types of surveys, usually state surveyors. And relatively steady over the past 5 years, Sue. There was a big increase in deemed status surveys back in 2008. But after that period of time, it's relatively small growth. It is going up, but it is relatively steady. So here's another interesting statistic. So for deemed status surveyors, surveys in 2017, the largest number of surveys were performed by AAHC with 808. And they performed in that year 159 initial ones and 198 reaccrediting. So they by far are the largest provider of deemed status surveys, and they also had the highest number of new surveys. Second was the Joint Commission with 599 total surveys, 82 new ones and 157 reaccrediting. And third of the top three, QuAD-ASF, which had 191 surveyed organization, 32 new ones, and 46 reaccrediting.
I'm not the math whiz in this, but that doesn't total.
So let's look at AAHC. So there were 808 accredited organizations. Now, they get a 3-year accreditation generally. And so there's in each year, you would think that there's about a third of them that are going to have reaccreditation and, of course, new ones that are coming on board. So the rest of those organizations, to answer your question, are organizations that are just not due for reaccreditation in that year.
Okay.
So interesting statistics here. So during the follow-up surveys where CMS and the state surveyors are checking to see how well done the surveys are, they found a disparity rate of 36% in 2017. So that's the overall rate, meaning that in 36% of the time, the surveyors found significant differences between their survey and the survey that was performed by the accrediting organization. So, and that means that the accrediting organization missed various significant deficiencies within the organization. So here are a breakdown, and I'm not sure the accrediting organizations are going to want to hear this, but here is the breakdown of those organizations with the highest to lowest number of the top three. I'm not going to go through the top three, the highest to lowest disparity rates. So the highest rate of disparity, meaning the highest number of surveys that showed that the accrediting organization didn't catch all of the discrepancies or the deficiencies, was Quad ASF with 67%. So that meant 67% of the time Quad ASF missed a significant deficiency. Second was the Joint Commission with 45%. So again, 45% of the time Joint Commission missed a significant deficiency. Of the top three, really the only ones that were actually significantly measured or had statistically accurate numbers was HHHC, and they had 23%. So it is interesting that HHHC had one half of the second highest number, which was Joint Commission. So speaking as a HHHC surveyor, you know, I'm very proud that we had the lowest number there, but still 23% is not a number that we should necessarily be proud of. So those numbers and those statistics are used to work with the survey organizations to try to improve the quality of those surveys.
Yeah, and you could never really have a completely low number, though, don't you think? Even if the same organization goes in twice, they always find something different. You can't possibly see everything.
Right. And another argument that could be made too is that, you know, these surveys, these follow-up surveys, validation surveys are performed up to 60 days after the survey that was performed. And the organization isn't prepared for that follow-up, whereas they might be slightly prepared for an accrediting organization to come in. So they probably, unfortunately, in many cases, go back to their old ways. They might have been in their best behavior when HHC or, you know, Joint Commissioner Quad ASF came in. But then after the survey is performed, they go back to their old ways in some cases. And that's when the state comes in and they catch this. So, that, you know, in all fairness, that might be part of this also. Of course, I think that's one of the things that this contemporaneous survey might be able to resolve, because the surveyors that are coming in from the state are going to see the same things that the surveyors from the accrediting organization will see. So very good information. Oh, I should also point out the physical environment rate. So there's a lot of discussion right now about which of the survey organizations perform the toughest physical environment surveys. Now, this isn't going to give us an answer to that, but the disparity rates for physical environment were as follows. So again, Quad ASF had the highest disparity rate at 33%, again, meaning 33% of the time they missed physical environment citations. Joint Commission was second at 26%, and HHC came in at 14%, again, almost half of the Joint Commission number. So I just can say from a HHC standpoint, you know, I certainly know a lot of those surveyors that work for HHC and do those surveys, and they really are good. Of course, we have one of them. Jim Masters works for us in addition to being a surveyor with HHC. So that just shows that, again, a lot of work has been done to improve these numbers. I don't have numbers here to compare to, but these numbers were significantly higher in the past, and definitely they've been able to bring it down. So I thought that was a very good thing to talk about during this episode.
And the 2019 salary survey results are available through the ASC Association. The survey allows ASCs to compare their compensation packages to similar ASCs. It helps with negotiating a raise or determining salary and benefits for a new position. ASCs can benchmark their information with other ASCs in the same region with a similar number of employees of the same specialty, with a similar number of patient encounters, and more. So the ASC members pay $299 for the report, and non-members pay $399. So that would be really useful information for a lot of people.
It is. Some of our clients actually use it to work with the governing body of their organization to try to negotiate salary changes during the year. And this is an extremely important tool and valuable tool for everybody. So if you feel you're being underpaid as an administrator or nurse manager and you're listening to this podcast, this might be a way to negotiate an increase. So definitely go to ASC Association and pick it up.
And the EPA just issued new rules on hazardous waste disposal, management standards for hazardous waste pharmaceuticals, and amendment to the P075 listing for nicotine.
So that's got an interesting name. I don't know why nicotine is included in there, but I think they're actually talking about the nicotine patches, which don't apply to us. But so this is quite an interesting rule. We knew it was coming. We really haven't talked about it on the podcast here. We know overall it's not a good idea to waste your pharmaceuticals down the drain, but really it hasn't been particularly illegal, just not a really good thing to do up until now. So this new rule prohibits healthcare organizations from disposing of hazardous waste pharmaceuticals down the toilet or drain. So it's also that that process is also known as sewering. This is a commonly used method of disposal, and it's banned effective August 21st, 2019. So if this is what you've been doing, I think most of our centers by now are not doing that, please stop it. And there's a lot of good products out there. There's various buckets or containers that you can dispose your products into. I'm not going to mention their names here, but you can.
But they'll deactivate it, or
It's basically a charcoal-based product that you dispose it into this jug, and it neutralizes the item. Yeah. So let's take a break, and then we'll come back, and we're going to talk about our topic of the podcast, which is risk assessments.
So this week we're going to talk about some of the major risk assessments that ASCs have to do. The NFPA 99, the wet procedure room assessment, and hazard vulnerability analysis. And there is one other major one, the infection control risk assessment, which we're going to cover in a future episode.
Right. So as I was preparing for this, I really thought I could squeeze everything in, but quite frankly, we're going to have to gloss over even all the three that we're talking about. And, you know, at some time in the future, well, we do talk about these things on an ongoing basis, but we'll get into a little bit more granular in future episodes. But at least here, get yourself prepared for this. Make sure that you're doing these. We're going to tell you how to Google for the most recent risk assessment tool. So I'll give you the words to put into your Google search, and example risk assessments will pop up when you do that. So let's start with the NFPA 99 risk assessment. So this is a risk assessment that we always do, but we don't always know that we're doing it, and we don't always document it. And basically what this risk assessment does is it looks at all of your equipment. You go room by room and identify all the equipment in a room, as well as the main built-in equipment, to identify what the risk is of that equipment malfunctioning, or what types of things could happen if you didn't, and then what you do in order to mitigate or to reduce the chance of some type of a catastrophic outcome resulting from the failure of that equipment. So you really do the NFPA 99 risk assessment once, and then you just update it every year. There aren't really a lot of changes generally that happen from one year to the next, and once you get a good one done, it should last you for a while. The best risk assessment is probably the one prepared by the American Society of Healthcare Engineering, or ASHE, A-S-H-E, and you can download this risk assessment if you just Google the following words, A-S-H-E, NFPA 99, risk assessment, and then a whole bunch of examples of this. It basically comes out in an Excel spreadsheet, which I know you hate working with, Sue, but you're learning.
This one is a confusing looking one, this but really, is. Alex walked me through it, and it really is not as confusing as it looks.
Right. I think the tougher thing with this risk assessment is the first one that you do. Once it's been done, going through it on an annual basis, and that's basically what you do, is you know, it's usually performed by somebody else or, some type of an engineer, and then you just update it every year or work with a client on that.
Unless you're changing the procedures you do, is that correct?
That's correct.
Because and even, it seems to be the driving force is whether if things failed, you know, your patients would be at risk or not.
Right, right. So, and then we're actually talking about major changes, like, you know, maybe you were not doing equipment using a C-arm before, but now you are. So that would be a major change that would have to affect
or levels of anesthesia.
Correct. Excellent example is when we're changing levels of anesthesia, which many of our clients have been doing lately, actually. So that's a good example.
So let's go through the process. The goal of the NFPA 99 risk assessment is to determine what level or category the following building systems fall under in the event of a total catastrophic failure of that system. So there's gas and vacuum systems, electrical systems, HVAC systems, electrical equipment, and gas equipment.
Right. And with each of these, there are four levels or categories of failures or the types of issues that could happen. So a category one are systems in which failure is likely to cause major injury or death of patients or staff. Category two are systems in which failure is likely to cause minor injury to patients or staff. Category three are systems in which failure is not likely to cause injury to patients or staff. And category four are systems in which failure would have absolutely no impact on patient care or staff.
I kind of think of it, you know, if it's just a doctor's office, you're not doing any actual procedures. If your air conditioning goes out or your electricity shuts down, so they, you know, everybody just goes home.
Right.
But obviously, if you've got people in the middle of an operation,
right,
you know, it's much more serious.
That's right. So, you know, HVAC systems, the systems that maintain the temperature, humidity, and sterility in the operating rooms, those are categories two or one in an ambulatory surgery center, for example. So a lot of these will fall into category one and two with some of those major systems, especially when we get to electrical systems and sometimes the gas and vacuum systems. So using the risk tool that's provided by ASHI, you determine the level of risk to the patient or staff for a catastrophic failure of the system, or what we would call a worst-case scenario. What happens if the total system goes down? There is not likely to be significant changes, as we said, year to year, unless you make major modifications to the equipment. And the conclusion of this risk assessment is that you identify what you're going to do to mitigate these risks. So we know what we do. Now mm-hmm. this tool shows us why we do that. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we know we have a generator for backup power. Well, the reason we have that is because a failure of an electrical system could result in a Category 1 or a 2 failure, which means that a patient would be significantly injured as a result of that failure. We also know that we want to test our equipment on a regular basis. We want to do preventive maintenance on the equipment. We want to replace equipment that's not functioning properly. So the result of this NFPA 99 risk assessment is that we do all the things that we are doing. And if we're not doing enough to make sure that we're not taking care of that, then we have to add additional procedures to do that. So the result of this is the very tools that we use on an ongoing basis to test things. So, for example, our electrical equipment, we test the generator on a monthly or weekly mm-hmm. basis. We test the exit lights in the organization. We test the battery backup lights, et cetera. So again, the NFPA 99 risk assessment is the primary vehicle that we use in order to determine what we do with our equipment testing and maintenance.
And just like all of the risk assessments, it's always about identifying where the biggest risk is and showing what we're doing to mitigate that risk, or, you know, pointing out if there's areas where we haven't mitigated as well as we should.
Right.
And that's what to focus on. So it's pretty right. much what they're all about.
So the next assessment is something that you probably don't think about much, and that's what we call the wet-dry assessment. So this is performed annually to assess the possible need for a line isolation monitor or a ground fault circuit interrupter or GFCI in the operating rooms. So the analysis looks to see if you have standing water, for example, that is being generated from the procedure, or if line electrical cords are within 6 feet of the patient, or if, you know, make sure that you have some extracting systems to remove fluids from the from the floor. So this is an interesting tool that's available from ASHI. You can Google it. If you just type in wet procedure risk assessment, you'll be able to get an example of this tool from ASHI. So the main reason that you would do this assessment is if you don't have a GFCI or a line isolation monitor in the operating rooms. So if your operating rooms are not equipped with that, then you absolutely have to do this assessment, and you have to do it on an annual basis, and you have to report the results to the governing body.
And that's not something that's going to change unless you change your procedures, at least.
Correct. Now, if you already have line isolation monitors or GFCI in the operating rooms, I would make the argument that you really don't necessarily need to do the wet-dry assessment because you've already determined that they're wet and that you need those monitors in there.
Yeah.
But of course, that disappears completely if you don't have it in each of the operating and treatment rooms. So definitely something to think about. It doesn't take long to prepare this. The ASHI tool actually runs you right through the whole thing. So definitely download that tool from the American Society for Healthcare Engineering, ASHI. And the last one we're going to talk about this week is the Hazard Vulnerability Analysis, or the HVA, which is a tool that came about as a result of the 2017 emergency preparedness rules that were implemented. So the Hazard Vulnerability Analysis is a process for identifying the center's major risks for a natural and man-made hazards and the direct and indirect effect that those hazards would have on the center. You redo it every year and revise the emergency preparedness plans accordingly. Usually this risk assessment is done on an Excel spreadsheet. If you want to get an example of one, an excellent one is just Google Hazard Vulnerability Analysis Excel, and you'll see a number of them out there. They pretty much all follow the same format, and they're an Excel spreadsheet also. So on the left-hand side, there's a series of rows for the various risks. For example, for naturally occurring events, you might have hurricanes, tornadoes, severe thunderstorms, earthquakes, tidal waves, floods, wildfires, epidemics, etc. Now, you know, you're depending upon where you are, you might mm-hmm. not have those. So certainly hurricanes are a very prominent thing. We're recording this while there's a major hurricane affecting the East Coast and the Caribbean. Tornadoes affect a lot of our middle states, where you have a facility in Ohio that at least has 2 tornado warnings per year. Severe thunderstorms affect really the entire country, especially the area we live in up in upstate New York. Earthquakes, you know, those are things that really only affect a number of different areas, a higher risk on the West Coast there than perhaps on the East Coast. Tidal waves, of course, hopefully don't affect Iowa. And, you know, flooding, depending upon where you're located. Wildfires mm-hmm. seem to be pretty endemic to California right now. And epidemics, of course, can affect anybody. But major metropolitan areas, of course, are probably more subject to the possibility of an epidemic breaking out and affecting a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So for each of those, and those are only examples. So, you know, you really have to assess in your own organization what types of things you would have. So for each item, you complete various columns. So first set of columns is you assess the probability that this will occur on a scale of 0 to 3. So 0 means that it's not applicable and you don't even need to include it. So usually you either just put a 0 down for that or you don't even include that as a line item. 1 would be a low probability. So a tidal wave in Iowa probably would either be a 0 or a 1 low probability. And a 3 is a high probability. For example, hurricanes in Florida, there's always a high probability that that would occur in the state of Florida.
Yeah, and then so for the next step, you would indicate what impact that would have if one of those things were to occur on humans, property, and business. So again, it would be the 0 to 3. 0 meaning not applicable. 1 is low impact, low chance of death, property damage, or interruption of services. And 3 is a high possibility of death, property damage, and interruption to services.
Right. So with this second set of columns, what we're doing here is assessing what would happen. You know, I mm-hmm. mean, maybe there's a high probability of something happening. But again, if it's not going to do much damage to human or property or business, mm-hmm. then that definitely diminishes the possible impact there. And then lastly, you'd indicate how prepared you are. For example,
do you have drills? Do you have good policies that will address these problems and people are well rehearsed in what to do?
Right. You know, have you done external drills where you've actually acted it out, or are you mm-hmm. just doing tabletop drills, or do you have not done any drills at all? We're only required to do 2 external drills a year. So you might not have prepared for an active shooter, for example. Mm-hmm. So that might show that you're not really prepared that well for it. So the second thing is, do you have the internal resources to deal with it? Do you have the equipment you need to deal with some type of a thing? Like in upstate New York, snowstorms are always on our list. Yep. So, you know, do you have the ability to deal with a very quick onset snowstorm? So do you have blankets? Do you have, flashlights, et cetera?
Kind of like in your car as you're driving to Buffalo.
That's right.
You've learned, keep the blanket in there, keep extra food, keep water. So
yeah, as for those that don't know, Sue's referring to a number of years ago, I was coming back from Ohio and I got stuck in the New York State Thruway for, I think it was about 20 hours. But of course, when I tell the story, it keeps getting longer. It's like 3 months now. but, you know, if luckily I was prepared mm-hmm. for it. I had a full tank of gas. I had a blanket. I had food. I had water. And I had an iPhone, you know, that I could contact people. But so are you well prepared internally to deal with those disasters?
And is there sufficient external resources to deal with it?
So that would be, you know, like if you have a hurricane, for example, are you on your own because nobody's prepared in your community for the hurricane? Yeah. Does that mean that you're going to have to deal with that crisis on your own, or are outside resources going to come to bear? Yeah. I think probably that comes down to epidemic. You know, what happens? How long does it take for the community to respond to something like a rapid onset epidemic like the types of things that we've been seeing lately? Most of them are relatively slow acting, but we do know that epidemics could, you know, be quite catastrophic depending on how quickly that spreads.
Yeah, and make sure in your emergency binders or your policies that you have the information on these external resources so people know where to reach out to.
That's right. And you're saying this because you've been working quite heavily on a disaster plan for one of our clients in Queens right now. So this is very much on the top of your mind, I'm sure.
Yep. And again, it's at 0 to 3, 0 being non-applicable, 1 meaning you have a high level of preparedness, internal resources, and external resources, and 3 meaning that you have little preparedness, few internal or external resources.
Right. And then mathematically, this spreadsheet does all kinds of voodoo and comes up with a relative threat number. The higher that threat number, the less prepared you are for that that type of a disaster, and the more that you have to do during a current year.
Yeah, so there's really only, you can't obviously decrease the probability or the seriousness. The only thing you can deal with is how prepared you are.
And some of these will always remain high. You know, I think a hurricane is probably going to be one of those that's always going to be somewhat high because you can never probably be as well prepared for it as you would like to be. But these numbers will change every year depending upon what you did during the previous year for preparing for it. So, and then it's important that once you fill out any of these risk assessments, that you don't just fill them out, but you also draw a conclusion from it. So what did this risk assessment tell you? In the case of a hazard vulnerability analysis, you know, what did you do? What are you going to be working on? By the way, that doesn't mean that you need to do it right away. So just because your hazard vulnerability shows that you got a 66% relative threat, you know, for dealing with an active shooter, well, it doesn't mean that you need to immediately go out and come up with new plans and do drills, you know, within the next 24 hours after doing it. You do these things the right way. You take your time to do it right. You do drills throughout the year. You research it, whatever you need to do, and you identify the fact that you're going to do some work on that particular area. And, you know, again, as I mentioned, with all these risk assessments, that they're going to differ depending upon what you did in prior years and the new equipment that you might have picked up or new potential disasters that you've been made aware of. For example, we never really thought much about active shooter until very recently when it started affecting us more heavily. So that's our quick little dive into risk assessments. Make sure that you are at least doing these three and an infection control risk assessment. We'll talk about infection control in a future podcast.
So let's take a break and we'll come back to talk about upcoming events in the ASC industry. So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. And if you'd like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
Also, we want to remind you that the ASC podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. John is available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting.
So the California Ambulatory Surgery Association annual conference is September 4th through 6th, 2019 in Monterey Bay. That's this week if you're listening to it during the week that we publish it. We're heading down there tomorrow morning, and we'll be doing some live recordings and as well as a special episode for CASAS, and I'm also speaking at that conference.
The Surgery Center Compliance Meeting will be September 23rd to 24th in Newark, New Jersey.
The Michigan ASC Association, or MASA, annual meeting will be in Mackinac Island on September 26th through 27th.
The Tennessee ASC Association's Fall Conference and Trade Show is September 26th to 27th at the Hilton Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee.
And the South Carolina ASC Association Infection Control Seminar is in Columbia, South Carolina, October 5th, 2019. We just came back from South Carolina.
I guess
we should have stayed a little bit longer. Of course,
no.
Right now, there's a hurricane heading that way. So luckily, that's another month from now. So I think they'll be okay.
Hopefully, everything will work out for them. And again, South Carolina Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's 4th quarter membership meeting in Columbia, South Carolina is October 8th, 2019.
The Indiana Federation of ASC's Fall Conference and Trade Show is October 18th, 2019 at 502 East Event Center in Carmel, Indiana.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis in New York.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference is at the Doubletree in Tarrytown, New York on November 6th and 7th, 2019.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
And then keep your calendars open for the ASCA 2020 Winter Seminars in New Orleans, Louisiana.
The Iowa Association meeting is April 17th, 2020.
And I've already, the reason that's on here is because I've already signed up to speak with that association in April. Okay. And of course, make sure you're prepared to go to ASCA 2020 in Orlando in April.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again. And please spread the word about our podcast to your friends and colleagues and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.